taxes was taxing. Now taxes is relaxing when you file for free.
I can file for free? TurboTax Free Edition. Roughly 37% of filers qualify. Simple form 1040 returns only. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free. I can file for free.
Now this is taxes. File for free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your maximum refund. No schedules except for earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and student loan interest. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today someone I've been reading for a very long time. I think, Peter, you don't remember, I'm sure, but I met you at Duke, I think in like 2007. You did like a small group seminar thing, and we talked about Jewish day school. I think I talked about Schechter, and
I remember that actually.
Yeah, very, very long time ago, almost 20 years ago, Jesus Christ. But we've invited Peter to talk about his new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So just the first question that I want to ask is I think a criticism some might have is why center being Jewish at this moment? Even if it's in the service of Palestinian liberation, what are you trying to do with the book?
I think it's a totally legitimate question, and it comes out of people's very genuine frustration that Palestinians still remain soft and so marginalized and dehumanized in these public conversations in the United States, that what Edward Said talked about famously, the lack of permission to narrate, still very much is the case today. And the Jewish feelings and sensitivities and identity often tends to kind of take center stage, even in the midst of this destruction of an entire society in Gaza. But I guess I think about what is my comparative advantage in trying to change this horrific U.S. policy and the complicity of the community that I'm part of. It seems to me if there's going to be a change and there's going to be Palestinian freedom, American policy has to change. And to some degree, the American Jewish community has to be part of that. This movement needs to center Palestinians, and it needs to bring in people from all forms, you know, walks of life. But anyone who follows this even casually will know the way that the organized American Jewish community, by using charges of anti-Semitism, by the way groups like AIPAC operate, makes that struggle to change U.S. policy much, much more difficult. So I think one element of this, only one element, but perhaps one that I'm better situated to engage in, is to try to help in some small way towards that change.
So, Peter, maybe it would be helpful to take a step back from the book and in a macro sense, talk about your own journey, I guess, is the word to use, on the Israel-Palestine question. I know you famously wrote a piece for the New York Times in 2020, I No Longer Believe in a Jewish State. And I think that kind of will ground the conversation for people. But where did that come from? And what's been sort of the process by which you've come to hold your views on this question?
So I think the attitudes that I had about Israel growing up were probably not that different from the ones of a lot of people, certainly of my generation, perhaps particularly because my parents were South African, which is a smaller Jewish community, a very Zionistic Jewish community. It was a very strong sense that Israel was a sense of security, that even if you didn't go live there, certainly if my grandmother, who was born in Egypt and lived in the Belt of Congo, she always felt, I remember saying, that kind of Israel is the one thing you can trust if you're Jewish, that it will make you feel safe. And then also I spent time in Israel and spent time in Jewish Israel, no real interaction with Palestinians. And I saw how much my father and my grandfather loved being there. And I also had this sense of the kind of wonder at being in a Jewish civilization, you know, when you come from being a small minority group in a largely Christian society, there is something very powerful about a place where being Jewish was kind of normative. It was only really kind of embarrassingly late in my life, in my 30s, that for the first time I went and spent time with Palestinians in the West Bank. And I had the same experience that I think many people have, which was that on the first day of that experience, I realized that I was going to have to rethink some things. Because although I vaguely had an understanding that things were not good, But it's one thing to kind of know that in a kind of abstract way. It's another thing to actually see what it means for people's lives when they live under a state that is completely unaccountable to them, that can basically take their lives with complete impunity. And the way in which that structures almost every part of your waking life, you know? And also when I met Palestinians, I was forced to reckon with the level of dehumanization that I had been carrying around myself towards Palestinians, you know, kind of always thinking about them as this faceless, vaguely threatening mass of people. And so I think for a long time after that, I thought that a two-state solution would be the best answer, because I guess it was the one that was on the table. First of all, I thought partly in the sense that Jewish tradition for me has always been interesting in the way it has a universalistic element and also has a kind of familial or tribal particularist element. I thought, well, this would be a good way of kind of balancing these two, because Palestinians will have citizenship in their own state. Israel won't be controlling all these stateless non-citizens, but Jews will still have a state that's kind of dedicated to their security. But of course, over time, it became harder and harder to claim that this was possible. I went back when I was writing something a while back, trying to find the first person who said that we were almost at the end of the two-state solution's lifespan. And I found a column by Anthony Lewis called 5 Minutes to Midnight, written in the New York Times in 1982, saying that if you got to 100,000 settlers, it was game over. Right now we have 700. So that's it. But even beyond that, sorry, this is a little bit long, but like I began to have to confront the ways in which partition was not just impractical, but not just that, because the way it's generally conceived of, it means that you have to maintain a Jewish demographic majority. So Palestinian refugees can't return. How in the heck can I say that I have the right to return after 2,000 years, even though no Beinarts have lived in this place for a very, very, very long time, and that someone who was born or their parents were born in Jaffa or Haifa or Lod or wherever can't return? It just doesn't pass the smell test and the kind of basic kind of notions of fairness. And also, you can't treat Palestinian citizens, who are 20% of the citizenry, equally if they live in a Jewish state, right? Because it's a state that essentially prioritizes the lives and rights of their Jewish neighbors over them. And maybe it was particularly also the rise of ethno-nationalism in the United States and the fears of what it would mean for the United States to be more explicitly a white Christian country and to see that in Europe as well, that kind of made me more aware of this contradiction between what I was defending within a smaller Israel and what I believed in the United States.
So I've got a couple of ways I'd like to go with this. First of all, could you maybe talk a little bit about how that silencing operated as you were growing up as a Gen X wunderkind who then becomes the editor of the New Republic? What were the sort of social structures that led to this implicit dehumanization of Palestinian life? And this notion, and I grew up in the exact same circumstances, wow, of, you know, you have a map of Israel and there's no West Bank or Gaza, right, in it, right? And so maybe you could talk a little bit about how that operated and then in Jewish social life, but then also in sort of the elite media spaces that you occupied in your 20s and 30s, yeah, and till today.
It's such an interesting question, because I think it's different actually than it was back then from what it was, where it is today. Because I think today, in a certain kind of way, there has to be more explicit, active repression and delegitimization of Palestinian and pro-Palestinian voices, because they kind of are there a little bit more, right? There's an awareness that there is this movement out there, that there's this shift in public opinion. So a group like the Anti-Defamation League, it has to kind of work harder to acknowledge there are these people out there and they are anti-Semites because they're anti-Zionist. We can't let them into the legitimate conversation. I think when I was growing up in the 80s and then in the 90s, in some ways that work didn't need to be done, because it was simply so taken for granted that Palestinians and their perspectives were outside of the norm. I mean, you had Edward Said as a kind of a sui generis kind of figure who would be brought on Charlie Rose or whatever, along with like three or four kind of pro-Israel Jewish thinkers. But in general, like, the voices just weren't nearly as present. That, you know, the BDS movement didn't even exist, right? So you had Yasser Arafat, but he was kind of an easy person for people to kind of just, you know, wave off. And so I think for me, again, a lot of this was just not even a conversation. It wasn't even really a debate. There was a debate, you know, coming out of the First Intifada about whether settlements were good and about whether you could imagine the idea of a Palestinian state generally within very limited terms, not really a fully sovereign state, but kind of some kind of glorified kind of autonomy. That was a conversation, but Palestinians were absent. And then when I moved to Washington and I, you know, worked at the New Republic and other places, they were just absent too. I mean, I think that it's very hard. And when you think about those period, maybe the nation was offering some, which were, you know, some, you could hear some before Hitchens became kind of neocon, and there were a few people, Alexander Coburn, there were a few voices, but they were not really present in Washington mainstream political discourse. And so in a way, it wasn't even a kind of, wasn't even that one had to really formulate the arguments very much as I remember them, right? Where it'd have to say, okay, how do I defend Zionism? Right. I think that wasn't even a conversation that in the spaces that I grew up in and then was working in really even came up.
So it might make sense now to talk a little bit about what you've seen happen in the Jewish community since October 7th. So what were the immediate responses? How did you yourself think about it? I do have to say pretty almost immediately after I thought Israel was going to do basically what it was going to do, that this was the perfect excuse that Likud has been waiting for since its inception. But what did you find? I'm a little bit isolated from the Jewish community out here in the Pacific Northwest. I'm not in sort of the beating heart in New York or DC or sort of the Acela corridor. So what was your experience of October 7th?
I mean, it was just completely surreal. It was completely surreal, partly because, as you may remember, it happened not only on Shabbat, but on the first of a two-day holiday in which Jews in my community, including myself, were not on forms of electronic communication until Sunday night. And this happened on Saturday. So there was, and it was also happening on this holiday of Simchas Torah and Shmini Atzeret. Simchas Torah is one of the most joyous days of the Jewish holiday. You're supposed to dance around with the Torah and be super happy, you know. And so the combination was completely surreal because people I was with didn't know the details of what was happening, but there was that they would know that something horrifying has happened. I remember people in our shul, because a lot of people have family in Israel, were trying to find non-Jews to turn on their phones to read the messages to see from family and friends in Israel to see if they were still alive. So it was totally horrifying. And there was a profound sense of grief and trauma and anger and demand for solidarity. And I felt from the very moment, like, completely torn, because that feeling I wanted to be part of that solidarity. I wanted to be part of that public grief. This was a moment I felt like to stand with other Jews and grieve together and to speak about the terrible thing that had been done, which was, you know, a kind of purposeful attack on civilians and the kidnappings and the horror. But then, as you say, so quickly, almost immediately, then Israel begins its response. As you say, you didn't have to be clairvoyant to see what was going to happen, right? Israeli leaders were saying it from the very beginning, right? We're going to cut off food. We're going to cut off fuel. We're going to cut off water, right? They are Amalek, right? This figure from the Bible that are called to be exterminated. And I had actually written earlier in the year, and looking at some other work that other people had done, basically saying that, you know, there were the conditions here in place for some kind of act of mass ethnic cleansing or even genocide. I had been thinking about it more in the West Bank than in Gaza. But you could see that the conditions were, because the Israeli government was unrestrained and it was unaccountable, and that it was increasingly radical, and that the basic management system of managing all these people who lack basic rights was kind of breaking down. I was thinking about the West Bank. It was breaking down because the Palestinian Authority was going to break down. And so if you have a return to Palestinian resistance in the West Bank and you can't manage it through the subcontract of the Palestinian Authority, I was reading people like Bezalel Smotrich who were saying, well, then we're going to have to get rid of them. I just didn't foresee it happening in Gaza. So it was a terribly agonizing scene, and I really struggled, and I don't know if I got it right, like to try to hold these different and express these different emotions that were so much in conflict with one another.
I think before we even move on, important thing here is historical memory. So what is your take on the peace process? I think that a lot of research has revealed it was basically bullshit, that for the most part, that it wasn't really ever going to give Palestine sovereignty. And to me, if you're kind of have that, you know, what is it, the fruit of the poison vine or whatever that legal doctrine is, like, it was never really that serious. And I do think it's important because I think a lot of American Jews will be like, well, we tried. You know, we tried and they never want it. They don't even want it. They just want to kill us all. So I'm just curious, like, how you – is it almost a historical memory question? First, what do you think about the peace process in retrospect? And second, how do you see that it works in modern American Jewish identity?
Yes, I agree. Now maybe if you start with 1988 when the PLO makes this historic decision to give up on its earlier vision of what was sometimes called the secular democratic Palestine and accept partition, what have been called the mini state, the state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem – maybe between 88 and this Madrid process in the early 90s, things could have gone in a different direction. There were people like Said and other many Palestinian intellectuals who believed that what the PLO did was right and believed in the idea of a two-state solution. But it would have required a very different American role, and it would have required the balance of power was so stacked against the Palestinians because of Israel's power and America's role. So, and also because the Palestinians are particularly weakened after the Gulf War when Arafat makes a bad strategic decision to throw in his lot with Saddam Hussein. And it's an era of American unipolarity that what you get is Oslo, right, in 1983, which Said famously calls a Palestinian Versailles. And I think that's from that point, that's the beginning of the problem because Oslo never, the deal in Oslo is that the Palestinians will accept Israel's existence, essentially, and also renounce violence. So they're giving up basically their trump cards, right? What are they getting in return? They're not getting a promise of a state. Israel never says this is going to lead to a state. And they don't even say we're going to stop settlement growth. All they say is we're going to recognize you as a legitimate negotiating partner, right? And because of that imbalance from the very beginning, and especially settlement growth, what happens is the Palestinians have this, you have a system in which settlement growth never ends. It continues and continues. And Palestinian life actually gets worse, not better, because Israel actually creates this entire infrastructure, right, to protect the settlements, which makes Palestinian life even more fragmented. And that the offers that the Israeli leaders make, famously, with that Barak makes at Camp David in 2000, are really kind of better understood as kind of forms of glorified autonomy rather than actual sovereignty, right? Israel's still going to control the airspace, the electromagnetic spectrum. It's going to have troops for a very long time in the Jordan Valley, which is 25%. It's going to annex 9% of the West Bank. It's going to have roads that can bisect the West Bank that Israeli military use, right? And one can make criticisms of the way Arafat responds in certain moments, but I think it's important to see whatever criticisms one has of the Palestinian leadership within the larger context of the fact that this is not really a process that was designed to give them a sovereign.
It's like criticizing the Washington Generals for not having the best plays, you know, like the Globetrotters were going to win in the end, and everything is just so stacked in the direction from the beginning. At least that's how I view it.
Right. And, you know, this is, you know, Aaron David Miller famously said that America acts as Israel's lawyer, right? And so we're really in an era of high unipolarity here. And so the Palestinians have no other, there's no other arbiter really of this, and all of America's domestic political incentives are stacked to basically be much more cognizant of Israel's political concerns and its domestic politics, right? Clinton is constantly concerned about Barak, and Barak is always saying, listen, I can't do this because my domestic politics won't work. But he never allows Arafat to say the equivalent of that same kind of thing. There's a real imbalance.
And so what role do you think that the peace process plays in American Jewish memory? Because I think it's actually really key to what happened in Gaza and what's been going on in Israel for the last 10, 15 years in your own community.
Right. So the idea is that basically Palestinians deserve what they get now because they had this opportunity to have their own country and they blew it, right? And people don't even use the peace deal. People will say 1947. And I mean, they have this whole litany. Again, these are like statements that kind of, I don't know, it's almost like you push F1 on your keyboard, right? And people repeat them over and over again. As you know, because you're, you know, a historian, like if you look at actual scholarship on these things, right, you actually find there's not really very much scholarly support for this narrative of, you know, they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, right? In reality, at each of these junctures, the things that are being offered to Palestinians, if one tries to spend a moment thinking about a Palestinian perspective, it's pretty it's pretty easy to understand why these things are deeply inadequate from their perspective, right? But yes, I think this becomes this weird way of kind of saying, okay, now Israel is absolved of all responsibility, which just doesn't make any sense. Like, even if it were true that the Palestinians had really screwed up 20 years ago, it's like, I sometimes imagine, let's imagine that Martin Luther King goes to meet with Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson says, here's the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. And King says, not good enough. Screw you. And so it doesn't get passed. And then you say, well, 20 more years of segregation, they had it coming, right? It just doesn't make any sense, right? Even if you did believe that Palestinians bore all the responsibility. But I do think this is a way, these are the things that people say to allow them to sleep at night, to allow them to basically to see what's happening in Gaza or the West Bank, and be able to say, yeah, that looks really bad, but it's not our fault as a community, and it's not the fault of the state that we love.
And this brings us very naturally to what I wanted to talk about next, which is this process of Palestinian dehumanization amongst American Jews and Israelis as well. But I think we're focusing more on America here. My ultimate, almost macro level historical perspective is that the Jewish dehumanization of Palestinian people is almost the cost of becoming fully white in the settler colonial project of European modernity. That you have the apex of the Jew as other is in the Holocaust. Europe is now Judenrein, that Hitler succeeded. Europe is for not 100%, but not what it was. It is now free of Jews in a real sense. Jews were granted by the Western powers their own settler colonial state in the Middle East. And the price of becoming fully enfranchised in the Western mind, or what in academic parlance might be called becoming white, but you don't even need becoming white. People know what I mean. Becoming part of the community comes at the cost of Palestinian dehumanization. And that this is the ultimate sort of path of the Jewish people in modernity since roughly 1500. I'm just curious what you think about that, and then more broadly, what you think about Palestinian dehumanization and how it came to be that this, what happened in Gaza, is viewed as in any way, shape, or form acceptable.
Yeah, there's so much there. I think part of Palestinian dehumanization, to take the context that you're talking about, is simply the dehumanization of people in the colonial world, or post-colonial world, right, who are just seen, considered to be backward and not deserving of the same rights and status as everybody else, and that still
endures. Which is, of course, what the Jews were, internally colonized people, some might say, in Europe themselves, and then they transfer. Yeah,
right. But the Jews are on the one hand Europe's other, and on the other hand, the Jews who create the Zionist movement are very, very European, right?
Precisely.
And so they are thinking about. Said says that, it's not coincidence Zion was born in the high age of imperialism, right? That the notions that the Zionists had about what they were doing in Palestine was very similar, right, to what to non-Jewish Europeans were trying to do in other parts of the world. So when Herzl writes to Cecil Rhodes, the arch-imperialist of Southern Africa, and says, hey, you should support what we're doing because it's a lot like what you're doing, that's not really surprising, right? These are European projects.
He's an Austro-Hungarian, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire is very different from the British Overseas Empire. So there is the move, I think, to Western Europe is actually crucial for Herzl, because he's emergent from a very cosmopolitan space. And you have another Austrian like Karl Popper developing cosmopolitan ideology, and that you should all live in the cities. So there is as Herzl moves west, he becomes more almost like genocide. Not genocidal is not the right word, but he becomes more colonial. That's probably the right
interesting
word.
Interesting, yeah. Right. And, famously, there's a debate, but famously he was in Paris during around the Dreyfus trial. And right. Some people say that that's when he lost his belief in European liberalism. So, yes. And obviously, it's important to say that there were other Jews, many, many other Jews, who had different visions of how to solve the Jewish question, whether it was a Marxism or liberalism or some kind of nationalism experience that could exist in Europe, Bundism, or these kind of things.
Or capitalism, right? Everyone's equal on the market, right? I think that's Soros. That's why Soros became, it's like everyone's equal on the market.
Right.
You're just how much money you can move around. And I think that's really actually important to understand.
Right,
the late 20th
century. But I think when you think about today, though, I think you're also right that certainly on in the right, on the political right in the United States and Europe, and even in the center to some degree, I think the esteem that people have for Jews is very much connected to the Israeli project, and the fact that Israel in some ways is, for a lot of folks, a kind of more successful version of the kind of a kind of settler colonial state than they see in their own countries, right? I mean, in some ways, like, imagine if you're a right-wing Canadian or Australian and you think, oh my gosh, we have these land acknowledgements all the place. Like, we go around flagellating ourselves all the time for this kind of thing. Look at Israel, right? They don't feel this sense of self-hatred. They're proudly, strongly nationalistic. They believe in the kids serve in the military. They have an immigration policy that maintains their demographic majority. They haven't all become secular or super. It's like, this is what we want in the West more generally. And I think that's they're obviously completely connected to the dehumanization and degradation of Palestinians. And what makes Israel such an icon for so many people around the world, in the West and beyond the West. Narendra Modi, too.
So what is the state of liberal Zionism? I remember my first big move away from, from liberalism was just like, liberal Zionism makes no sense. That it was almost doomed from the beginning. And I'm just curious on your larger take as a former liberal Zionist, where do you see it is? Because I think that a lot of Jews, particularly over, let's say, 45, 50, would define themselves as liberal Zionist. So as a macro project, where is it today?
I mean, I think in a certain way, it barely exists. I mean, first of all, if you were genuinely a liberal Zionist, right, what you would be doing would be you would be supporting the existence of Israel within the 67 lines and fighting like hell, right, to get Israel out of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, right? So maybe it's actually hard to think about. Maybe you could say J Street plays that role to some degree, but most people who we think of as liberal Zionists actually aren't doing that. They're not spending their time trying to defund the settlements and put sanctions, right? They're actually just saying it would be good if there was a Palestinian state one day, and I hope I live to see it, kind of, right? So they're actually, I mean, oftentimes the people who claim to support a Palestinian state who are liberal Zionists remind me a little bit of a person who's, you ask them, what's your position on running the New York Marathon? And you say, I'm for it. And you say, great. Have you gone running at all? No, you seem like you're sitting on your butt and eating chocolate cake all day, right? Like, you're not actually, that's not actually your position about running the marathon, right? So I think that liberal Zionism was this position about that what Israel is wrong on one side of the green line, but right on the other side of the green line, was a position that had a lot more intellectual heft a decade or two than it does today. I think there were many more prominent figures who had a lot more influence in American public discourse, making that argument emphatically than you find today. So to me, it feels in some ways what's happened is that it's lost a lot of its intellectual and cultural cachet, but it's still the de facto position of kind of the Democratic Party in a kind of zombie way, right? Not with any intellectual substance, but it has the resources and political strength to kind of crush you if you challenge it.
Do you think there's a disconnect or maybe a blindness on the part of people who still talk in liberal Zionist terms in the United States about, you know, wouldn't it be nice if there was two states, when it comes to the actual politics on the ground in Israel? Because there's nothing in Israeli politics right now that points in that direction. There's nobody really, there's fringe, like even what you could have considered the mainstream liberal movement is now a fringe in the Knesset. It's just not there.
Absolutely. There was a vote in the Knesset last year on the question of two states, and there was not a single member of a Jewish political party who voted for it, right? So the Labour Party so this is exactly right. So I think that, again, there's an unwillingness to actually see the reality that exists on the ground, and an unwillingness to recognize that in some ways, the nature of Israeli political debate as it relates to the two-state solution is also partly a function of the ethno-nationalism of Israeli politics in general, because there is a group of Israeli citizens who generally are pretty sympathetic to the two-state solution. They have been. Those are the Palestinian citizens, right? who are 20% of the population, right? But they are, although they can vote and serve in the Knesset for now, although it's often somewhat tenuous because by law, you're not supposed to be able to run in Israeli elections if you deny Israel's existence as a Jewish state. And they've managed to find loopholes around that, but that may change. But they're not fully legitimate members of Israel's political system. You can't imagine them as full members of a governing coalition influencing Israeli policy towards the Palestinians. And the whole way we talk about Israel and the United States is so suffused with this ethno-nationalist prism, right? How many times have we heard that Israelis all agree from the left to the right that, you know, we need to bomb Iran or that the Palestinians can't be trusted to state? We use Israeli as a synonym for Israeli Jew, as if the Palestinian citizens don't exist, let alone the 50% of the population, right, under Israeli control who are Palestinian. And so all of this, I think, is part of the problem in the way we think about this.
Taxes was taxing. Now taxes is relaxing when you file for free.
I can file for free? TurboTax Free Edition. Roughly 37% of filers qualify. Simple form 1040 returns only. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free. I can file for free.
Now this is taxes. File for free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your maximum refund. No schedules except for earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and student loan interest. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free.
Let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in Gaza. I watched your video about why you feel comfortable acknowledging that what's been happening in Gaza is a genocide. Can you talk a little bit about your process in coming to that conclusion and how the discussion around what to label this has been, you know, among the folks that you talk to and who have reacted to some of your work? What's been that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, what strikes me about the succession of terms that people in the organized Jewish community hate and try to kind of render, you know, illegitimate, whether it's apartheid or settler colonial or Jewish supremacy, is that it's really not about the specific meaning of these terms. I mean, one can have a specific meaning about the international legal definition of apartheid and genocide and what historians mean by settler colonies. I mean, those are all perfectly legitimate debates, but really, the way those terms function is basically as signifiers of something that's really, really bad, right? Like, these are the worst kinds of things that you can do or be as a state, right? And so I think American discourse always wants to say that terms that signify the worst things have to be associated with America's adversaries. They can't be associated with America's allies. America's allies make mistakes and, you know, but are basically fundamentally benevolent in some different way than American adversaries. So that kind of American exceptionalist discourse operates. And then there's a Jewish exceptionalist discourse, which is a version of that, which is essentially to say, sure, Israel makes mistakes. Sure, I don't like Netanyahu. Sure, the settlers can be assholes. But fundamentally, Israel could never be put in the category of doing the things that the worst countries do, right? And so I think that's essentially what provokes this animus at a term like genocide or, you know, or apartheid or whatever these other terms are.
How much power, I guess, or not power necessarily, but how much do American Jews load onto settlers as this kind of boogeyman who represent everything too far, too extreme? These are the people that you can blame for, you know, the trouble, the mobs in the West Bank or the people who want to march into Gaza and bring settlements back there. It feels like,
yeah,
for a lot of people, the settlement movement becomes this convenient thing to point at and say, well, look, I'm not like those people,
right?
Even though, even as you say, you know, there's little movement toward anything that would actually bring about the, you know, the two-state solution or rights for Palestinians, or little concern about that. When challenged on it, it's always like, well, I'm not like the Ben-Gvirs. I'm not like Smotrich. I'm not like those guys.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think, first of all, it's partly because a lot of Israeli Jews who are kind of in the political center and a lot of American Jews have a kind of cultural antipathy towards what they think of as religious extremists or religious fundamentalists. So part of this is a kind of an inter-Jewish culture war, which has to do with religion and secularism, right? And so that, and so there's a tendency to say they are extremists and they're brutal because they are these religious fanatics and we are modern, you know, enlightened people. But, you know, the truth is that, you know, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich have still never expelled nearly as many Palestinians as like a young Yitzhak Rabin did in 1948, you know, under the leadership of David Ben-Gurion. And these were settler kind of kibbutznik socialist Israelis, right? So there's a long tradition here of expelling Palestinians and denying Palestinians basic rights. Israel from 1948 to 1966, when the Likud party had no shot at power, when it was completely dominated by labor, socialist, secular Zionists, held Palestinians under military law from 1940. So this is a deep part of the tradition, you know, secular among secular religious, you know, quote unquote left and right Israelis. And so the settler project is also, it's a project of the Israeli state, right? These are not independent actors. Now, it's true, they can be a nuisance for the Israeli state sometimes, and sometimes they can, but in general, the only reason these settlements can exist in the West Bank is because they are protected by the Israeli army, and because the Israeli government has put huge amounts of money into maintaining this infrastructure, right? Not to mention the fact that they are now a very important kind of almost backbone of some of the military units of the Israeli Defense Forces.
And I think to bring it back to politics and bring it back to the Democratic Party, you see that reflected in the way that the Biden administration tried this token policy of right. sanctioning these extremist, quote unquote, extremist settlers without any, you know, appetite for going after the systematic institutional things that support the settlement movement. It was just sort of for show, it seemed like.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And it was also a kind of way of saying, because we're not going to stop sending Israel the arms that are destroying Gaza, it's a kind of look over here, we're doing this thing here in the West Bank.
So just building off what you said about the history of Israel and how this sort of oppression is baked in, do you think this was ultimately coming, that this was overdetermined, that some form of ethnic cleansing was inevitably going to happen, barring the United States or another basically supplier to a client saying you can't do that?
I mean, it does kind of look that way. I mean, in the sense
it that... It sure does kind of look that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I don't know. I mean, because giving Palestinians equality and citizenship in Israel has never been on the table. And because this process of... And because a Palestinian state has kind of also that ship sailed quite a long time ago, that in some ways it was probably, now we can think of it, that the system of kind of management, Israel had this kind of management system, the Palestinian Authority as a subcontractor in the West Bank working with the IDF, and in a strange way, Hamas also becoming a kind of partner of Israel, right, in recent years, with what Tariq Bokoni calls the violent equilibrium, that you bomb sometimes, but also you send messages to one another. And Israel under Naftali Bennett, you know, they had this idea that, and even under Netanyahu, we're going to maybe let them have some aid, some money. The Qataris can give them some money so they won't totally starve. And maybe even a few of them can come into work in Israel, and we'll have this carrot and sticks and we'll manage that, right? I think in retrospect, we see that was inherently probably a very unstable kind of system and one that was weakening. And then you say that you have no external restraints on what Israel's doing. So what is Israel going to do as the management system starts to collapse most spectacularly and horrifyingly on October 7th? And also, again, to, you know, so you say, okay, well, what's our solution to this problem? And then is it so surprising that Israelis would go for what we could call an American solution, which is like in the 19th century, the United States didn't say, okay, great, we stop at the Mississippi and then the Native Americans can have everything west of here, right? The process is continued because there was nothing to stop it, right? And so the system of norms and restraints or whatever that exist in 2024 are simply far too weak to stop this process, at least so far.
So would someone like Marty Peretz say it's just worth it for Jewish security? Is that the answer? The Holocaust happened. We see what happens when the Jews aren't ethno-nationalist. I think there's a line in Munich. It's like we can't be decent any longer. I'm just curious what the sort of pro-Israel ethnic cleansing response would be.
Well, it's interesting. You know, there's this famous chapter in Amos Oz's book, In the Land of Israel, where he interviews a guy he calls Z. And Z is striking because Z speaks without any sugarcoating or moralizing whatsoever, which is something I find you find a little bit more in Israel than you find among American Jews in general. And he says, we are going to exterminate them. And this is what's going to happen. People will be very upset at us. And then it will be over, and then we can repent and we can feel super guilty just like those Europeans and just the Americans. And he even says to Amos Oz, I'll do the work of extermination. And then you can be the person who goes to all the conferences and talks about how you feel guilty.
I joke about in 25 years, there's going to be land acknowledgments from the Trump Hotel in Gaza City. Right. Yeah. Like that. Yeah. That's like, I mean, the plan.
Right.
You know?
It's horrifying. Right. But I mean, yeah. So that's a particular kind of discourse. I think it's interesting to ask why it is that most official American Zionist discourse doesn't speak that way. Right. Because in a way, you could say that that is there under the new surface, because the support for Israel is unconditional. So whatever Israel does, you come up with a post hoc justification for it. And you basically say, yeah, it's really too bad. It's awful. But the Palestinians brought it on themselves. Right. But there's also something about maybe not in the far reaches of the Trumposphere, but in kind of the center of American politics, that you can't quite say that. You have to say, no, Israel's a democracy. Israel really wants Palestinians to have freedom, but, you know, they're just not ready for it and they can't be trusted with it. And I think perhaps that the fact that we still need to have that discourse does create the sense of opportunity, in the sense that people can then respond to that and say, we take this discourse seriously about democracy and equality under the law, and therefore your policies, the things you're supporting, are in fundamental violation and contradiction of that. Whereas maybe if you don't even have the hypocrisy or the disingenuousness, then you're just dealing with raw, naked, brutal power. Maybe that is the way things are going anyway. And maybe that's worse.
I would say that's where things are. I don't think there's much in the history of colonialism. That argument just has never really worked. You know, they give up the Philippines when they don't really need it because they have a base there, you know, and then they control the country anyway. Yeah. But I think it's worth pausing on this question of Jewish security, because when I talk to people in the Jewish community, that's ultimately what it comes down to, right? Like it's terrible. I don't like it. But Jewish security is dependent on the existence of ethno-nationalist Israel because of the Holocaust.
Right.
So I was wondering what your take on that argument is. I don't buy it, because I think we're actually in a very different world than the first half of the 20th century Central Europe. But I'm curious what you think.
Well, first of all, there's this strange thing that you hear this from people who are sitting in Chicago or New York or Miami, right? And they're not living in Israel. And one reason they're not living in Israel is because it's more dangerous for Jews in Israel than it is in the United States, right? And that every large diaspora Jewish community in the world today, Jews are safer than they are in Israel, right? And in all of those communities, Jews are kind of placed their safety on some notion of a system of equality under the law, right? I mean, not equal in practice, but that they believe in these principles, right? So there's something to me just odd about the fact that these principles that oftentimes we kind of almost worship in American Jewish discourse when we talk about America, right? We believe that in Israel, they would lead to Jewish death. And to me, it feels like this is not a particular Jewish story. It's a normal story about the way in which people who become accustomed to supremacy see supremacy as their survival and equate equality with death. You know, certainly, again, I'm the child of South Africans. That was just taken for granted in white South African discourse. I quote in my book Ian Paisley, the Protestant leader of Northern Ireland, on the eve of the Good Friday Accords, which give Catholics political equality. He calls it a prelude to genocide, right? It's the same discourse, right? So to me, I mean, and this is, I know this is kind of crude and simplistic, but it seems to me as a basic matter, you know, that actually, if you give people a voice in government, if you give people the vote, the market for violence tends to go down, because people have some nonviolent mechanism for getting their needs met to some degree, right? So white South Africans looked at the ANC's military wing, the Konte Wesizwe, which they thought was very, very frightening, which is labeled a terrorist organization by the United States, backed by the Soviet Union. They said, apartheid protects us from that. If apartheid's not there, we will be at the mercy of these guys who are going around, you know, saying, you know, one settler, one bullet, which was the Pan-Africanist Congress's slogan during, you know, in the 1980s. But it turned out, this is Mahmoud Mamdani and many others have made this point, it turned out that Mkhonto Wesizwe had no reason to exist once Black South Africans had the vote, right? Because there was another mechanism for political for having Black South Africans be able to have the government respond to them. And that's why I believe that, and again, you know this, Derek, that most people, you know, and Daniel, most people think, look at me like I have three heads when I say this in Jewish spaces. But I believe the Israeli Jews would be safer under conditions of legal equality than they are under conditions of legal supremacy. And I think one of the reasons that Israeli Jews are less afraid of Palestinian citizens than they are of Palestinians in the West Bank, because the same Israelis who are too terrified to go to the West Bank, let alone Gaza, go on the operating table and are treated by Palestinian doctors and nurses all the time, is because those Palestinian citizens have some voice. I mean, they're profoundly discriminated against. But the fact that they have citizenship at all actually means that there's less of a market for violence among Palestinian citizens than there is among Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza.
Maybe we could talk about this a little bit more in terms of the discourse around Israel's security and the, you know, the need to protect Jews around the world. And because what gets lost in this, to me, is any sense of agency for the Palestinians. And you can see this anytime a reporter, goes to a State Department briefing and dares to ask, after the, whoever's doing the press conference says, we believe Israel has a right to self-defense, dares to ask, do Palestinians have a right to self-defense? Right. And the question is like, you can see the flop sweat coming off the heads of these people, as they try to process that.
Right.
How do these conversations happen? I know at the official level for the U.S. government, it's just not, we don't talk about it. We don't respond to that question. We move on to the next one. We dodge it and move on. But how do they take place in communities among people who are interested or involved in this process? What is the recognition or non-recognition of Palestinian personhood, really? Because that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a non-recognition that kind of Palestinians are not considered to have the same rights as Jews are. And there's not a kind of a willingness in most mainstream Jewish spaces to try to imagine what the experience of a Palestinian would be like and how they might feel. You know, I mean, I remember this conversation I had with an extraordinary Palestinian activist in the West Bank named Fadi Karan, who's devoted his life to nonviolent resistance. And, you know, very influenced by Gandhi and King and all these things. And he said to me, I remember he did an interview, he said, Peter, you know, I'm a believer in nonviolence very, very passionately and strongly. He said, but, you know, we have no army to protect us here. We're completely defenseless, you know, against the government, against the state and a military and against settler violence. And he said, I sometimes think to myself, am I abrogating my responsibilities to my family by not trying to get a gun, right? And so if you think about it from that perspective, right, you can understand exactly the way he's thinking, right? I mean, but the Jewish, mainstream Jewish discourse doesn't allow people like Fadi Karan to speak, right? It's just taken for granted. You don't have exposure to Palestinians speaking in synagogues and Jewish schools. You don't have Palestinian authors being assigned. You don't have Palestinian. So all of this process of humanization that could imagine people thinking about life from the Palestinian perspective and understanding the kind of dilemmas that Palestinians face and humanizing people, unfortunately, it just still is very much not the norm.
I think it would make sense to talk about American Jewish institutions and how do you think that they've acquitted themselves during this post October 7th moment?
I mean, generally they've done, unfortunately, what I think you and I, Danny, would expect them to do, which is basically they support Israel no matter what Israel does, you know? And so it's amazing because, you know, there was this moment early on, you may remember, where it was pretty clear that there was reporting about this, that Israel wanted, and America even was pushing Egypt to open the border, right? So there'd be basically a mass expulsion of people. And it was so interesting in that moment because on the one hand, people would say, how dare you accuse Israel of wanting ethnic cleansing, right? That's a slander. It's anti-Semitic. And yet once the prospect of that emerged, I all of a sudden started hearing people say that would be such a humane solution, right? How dare the Egyptians stand in the way of this? How generous it is that Israel is willing to allow these people to go somewhere else and not be killed, right? And so it just, for me, was one of those moments where you can see how basically after whatever Israel actually decides to do, then people kind of figure out a way of kind of, and that's the function of the way these Jewish organizations operate, basically, as kind of, they kind of launder, rhetorically kind of launder what is Israel's actions and try to find some set of talking points and discourse. And these talking points and discourse, I mean, I spent part of the book writing about some of these, you know, that the Hamas health ministry's numbers are bogus, that it's only because of human shields, that Palestinians deserve it because they voted for Hamas, all these things. I mean, if you actually start to look into it and think about it in some detail and read about these things, really kind of crumble almost immediately. But they're not really arguments. They're just kind of defense mechanisms that allow you to basically go along with your life and not be lying awake at night thinking, what the fuck is this? And how am I managing to be complicit in it and support it?
So I have to ask this, and it's kind of comical, I guess. I mean, I laugh to keep from crying. But having watched over the last 15 months as the ADL, for example, has decided that anybody wearing a keffiyeh is inherently anti-Semitic and should be shunned from public life, only to then bend over backwards to excuse the richest man in the world throwing his right arm out at a rally for Donald Trump.
Roman salute, Derek.
It was a Roman salute, which was invented by Mussolini. But yeah, okay, sure. That's the explanation. He was just enthusiastic. He was. But what did you make of that? That was such a ridiculous thing to me. Just the juxtaposition of that response compared to what we've seen from that organization.
Right. So. In theory, the ADL says that there's an equal threat to Jews from left-wing anti-Zionist anti-Semitism and right-wing white nationalist anti-Semitism. I think if you look at actually academics who actually study anti-Semitism, and I cite some of the work of Eitan Hirsch and Laura Roden here, actually that parallelism is just nonsense. If you actually look at anti-Semitic attitudes as studied by academics, not by the ADL, which kind of cooks the numbers because they basically include a statement like river to the sea or apartheid is basically expressions of anti-Semitism. So, but in reality, the ADL doesn't even actually act like there's a parallel threat. They actually act as if the threat from Palestinian solidarity is a much greater threat, right? And I think this is also part of a thing about this too, just because the ADL is not afraid of what kind of retaliation they may get from Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib if they call them anti-Semitic. I think they are afraid of Elon Musk. And this is also, of course, you know, just the moment we're in, right? I mean, we are now, it's like a festival of cowardice from all America's leading institutions across the board because they're afraid of Donald Trump and Elon Musk. I think the ADL is also just afraid, right, of what Musk might do to them. And so they basically, it's easier for them to basically go after people in America who don't have much power.
I think as we head toward the end here, what do you think the future of American Jews' relationship to Israel is? Derek has mentioned that Israel is an increasingly hard right society politically. It's an increasingly anti-liberal society. American Jews are still steadfastly liberal. They still vote for the Democratic Party. And you could take this in whatever direction you want. There's clearly an age divide here. And as much of the rest of the politics in our society, once the boomers and above shuffle off this mortal coil, things will probably change and probably change relatively quickly, as tends to happen in American history. But what do you think the future of American Jews' relationship to Israel is?
So I think that the Zionist consensus is crumbling, and we're seeing that. I think it's remained strong in the Orthodox community, and the Orthodox community is going to be probably, if demographics continue, a more and more important part of American Jewish life. Just demographically, it's growing. More and more of American Jewish institutions are now really dominated by Orthodox Jews because they're the ones who care enough to really be involved in these institutions, which is very different than it was a couple of generations ago. But I think outside the Orthodox community, we're seeing that Zionism won't hold Jews together. Zionism increasingly divides American Jews, and right now these institutions we have don't express that, because almost all the institutions, the synagogues, et cetera, are all basically pro-Israel. But there is a really big increasing market for institutions that will serve Jews who are not fans of Israel and maybe not even don't even support Zionism. And there's no there. And I think what's going to be interesting to watch just in terms of American Jewish sociology is the way in which this group of younger American Jews, not all young American Jews, but a significant cohort of them, basically like try to grapple with what kind of Jewish institutions they want to live in, because the ones on offer are ones that don't speak to them and are alien. I've just noticed in New York, for instance, just in the last year, the number of minyanim, of kind of prayer spaces, these are not, they don't have buildings, they don't have rabbis, but of groups of Jews who just want to come to pray together in a non or explicitly anti-Zionist, that they've been popping up all over the place. And I think that those things probably will become institutionalized. If you just look at the number of people coming out of the Reconstructionist and Reform rabbinical schools, you know, a significant number of these people every year are graduating. These rabbis are not Zionists. And so something's going to happen there, which is going to manifest at this division. Now, will that in and of itself change American policy? Not in and of itself, but it could be part of what brings around about this shift.
And kind of the reverse. What do you think Israeli Jews' relationship to American Jews are going to be? That's an interesting one, which I think people don't talk about as much. But, you know, I'm not sure that Israeli Jews think so highly of many American Jews.
No, I know. I think that's true. I think they don't. I mean, first of all, you know, if you think someone like Netanyahu basically thinks, listen, these outside of the Orthodox community, these American Jews are halfway towards being Episcopalians anyway, or, you know, whatever. They're not really Jews. And they're not really going to matter as Jews in a generation or two as they assimilate more, right? And also that they see Jews as kind of, you know, even Israeli Jews who are not on the right, I think, look at American Jews as, you know, as kind of corrupted by kind of woke, kind of, you know, anti-nationalist kind of ethos that that for them is really pretty alienating, and which they, you know, they really fundamentally disagree with. You know, Trump is very, very popular among Israeli Jews. So, yeah, this is a really big divide. Now, Israel still needs American Jews, because American Jews play an important role in keeping the Democratic Party pro-Israel. And so I think that a shift in the American Jewish community can be maybe one of the reasons that the Democratic Party could potentially move away from its support of unconditional support of Israel. And that would have an impact, I think, and Israeli Jews, that would probably make Israeli Jews concerned, but they would respond with a sense of betrayal at American Jews for having allowed that to happen.
So, Peter, before we go, is there anything else that you want to add? Is there anything that you want listeners to be aware of?
I guess the book ends by making this argument that our relationship to the state of Israel has become idolatrous, and that saying that there's some useful ways of thinking about idolatry in Jewish tradition that might help us understand this discourse we have, which always centers the question of Israel's right to exist as if the state's right to exist is what matters, not the right of the human beings who live under the control of the state. And so maybe it's a very basic question, but I just try to make the point, I quote Abraham Joshua Heschel, who said that the only thing created in the image of God is the human being, right? And Yeshayahu Leibovitz, the Israeli social critic, who says that a state is only an instrument, it has no inherent value. And I think if we can remember that, then we can start to say, why are we worshiping this state and treating it as it has unconditional value, rather than saying, yeah, there's going to be a state here, or maybe even two states, right? And the question we should ask is, how is this state affecting the lives of all the people under its control? And if it's doing a really bad job of it, can we imagine recreating that state, reimagining it so it respects the lives and dignity of the people?
Peter Beinart, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone check out Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. We really appreciate you joining us. Thanks again.
Thanks so much. Take care.